The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I basically just think it would be interesting to look at the emergence of a criminal economy.
And also, I'm always amazed that there aren't more profiles of her out there.
This really subversive, strange thing, in rap especially.
And see what their lives are like on both sides of the border.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
It started way back in third grade. I used to sit beside Emmy Lou Hayes, a pink dress.
Pretty much every great singer reaches a point where he or she can start taking it easy. Show up to play the occasional concert, play the hits for the old fans, and everybody goes home happy. George Strait is certainly at that point in his career, but there's a wrinkle. Strait dominated the country music charts for decades, and depending on how you count the hits, he's got as many as 60 number ones under his belt. 60 of them. So playing them all in one night is kind of out of the question. What Strait is doing with this little conundrum is a series of concerts in Las Vegas where over two nights, he'll play all 60 number one hits. Strait recently sat down to talk about this retrospective show with The New Yorker's Kelafasane. And that in itself was unusual, because for many years, decades, Strait has avoided interviews entirely, avoided speaking on the record at all. That started in the 1980s after a tragedy, the death of his young daughter in a car accident.
I just didn't feel like talking about it, and I just quit doing interviews. I did want to keep singing, absolutely, but I was at the point where I'm going, all right, if this is going to cost me my career, so be it, you know, but I'm just not. I mean, it's the only way I'm going to be able to cope with it.
Right.
And so that's what I did. And it just kind of, turned out the way it did, you know. It wasn't an intentional thing, you know, the mystique, as some people say, and all of that stuff, you know. It was just a matter of choice.
Did it make a difference in your career? Did you notice that records were moving up the charts more slowly, or that tickets were selling more slowly, or did everything just keep going the way
everything
it was?
Everything just kept going. It didn't make a bit of difference.
That's terrifying to hear for someone like me.
Well, you know, I hear a lot of people go, you know, I want to do that, what George does. I don't want to do interviews and stuff. I'm going to do that.
That may be where Beyonce learned her strategy from. Another Texan singer.
I know.
Who does not do interviews.
She doesn't do interviews either. That's her heart.
George Strait is known for performing in this uniform that he's worn pretty much ever since the 1970s. A pair of jeans, typically Wranglers, and a shirt kind of starched and ironed.
I did iron my shirt, but I did not iron my jeans, because I thought you'd take one look at that and say I was trying too hard.
He says that he doesn't always get recognized if he's not wearing his trademark cowboy hat, and so seeing him on the tour bus, he's wearing, you know, running shoes and a baseball cap. He's got this dark tan, and so he looked a little bit different from the George Strait on the stage. He looked like he could be any successful businessman from Texas, which in a sense is kind of what he is.
Was that a number one record?
One of the funny things about George Strait's life is that he grows up in Texas, but he doesn't really become obsessed by country music until he's in Hawaii. He's in the Army, and he has some downtime, so he gets a guitar and some songbooks and starts learning the old country songs.
I eventually got the opportunity to sing country music for the Army. You know, we got a new commanding general, General Brooks, and he had done this thing in Korea where he started these bands from Army guys. He sent out word that he was going to start a country band, a rock band, a soul band, a Hawaiian band. And, you know, certainly getting the opportunity to go audition for that and then getting that job, that motivated me a lot.
But at the time, and correct me if I'm wrong, you know, you eventually you're back in Texas, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're playing these gigs and you're playing largely Texan-style country music. You're playing Western swing. Were you just imagining, oh, we could kind of do regional touring around the Southwest? Or were you thinking, no, I'm going to be on the radio?
I was totally thinking that. You know, once I played a few gigs in Hawaii and figured out that, hey, maybe I can really sing. Maybe I do have, maybe it's a possibility for me to maybe someday get a record deal and have songs on the radio. It was a huge dream.
Right.
You know, because, you know, but I'd seen it happen, you know, to people, and I'd seen it happen to Johnny Rodriguez. I'd seen it happen to Mo Bandy. I'd seen it happen to them, and I'm thinking, well, why not, you know?
All along, I knew I'd lose you, though I prayed that you'd be true. In your heart, please just remember, right or wrong, I'm still in love with you.
By the time it's the late 1970s, a lot of the country music that's on the radio, it's people like Kenny Rogers, it's Barbara Mandrell, it's people singing ballads, sometimes using string sections. And it's pretty different from what George Strait is doing. You know, he's this guy playing Texas roadhouses, covering Bob Wills and Merle Haggard. And so, from a certain perspective, he would have seemed like a long shot. He would have seemed like not the most likely person to be the next big country star. A couple things changed. He started kind of broadening his scope a little bit, showing that he could sing ballads, he could sing all kinds of country songs. The other thing that changed was John Travolta.
All right. Okay, ask me how you become bull rider.
How do you become a bull rider?
Oh, that's good.
In 1980, John Travolta and Deborah Winger star in this movie, Urban Cowboy, which is about people riding a mechanical bull in a bar in Texas called Gilly's, a bar that George Strait has actually played. And this sparked a mini craze for singing cowboys. And the idea of a real Texas cowboy who could sing had some glamour to it. Here's a real live cowboy. Here's a guy who's worked on a ranch. Here's a guy who knows how to rope. He had a kind of a real cowboy credibility, and that became a selling point. So George Strait gets this record deal with MCA Nashville, and his first single is this song called Unwound.
Give me a bottle of your very best, 'cause I've got a problem.
Doesn't go to number one, but it's a pretty big hit, and it kind of announces him as a new voice in country music.
I didn't really have all that high hopes for Unwound.
Mm.
I thought it was a good song. It had great fiddles in it, and, you know, it was up-tempo. It was way different than anything that was out there on the radio, for sure.
Johnny Paycheck or someone had turned it down,
Johnny,
right?
Paycheck, that's the story. They'd written it for Paycheck,
right.
And he was in jail, so they gave it to me.
There was then, and remains now to some extent, a certain amount of self-consciousness about how country radio stations want their country music to sound, and whether some listeners are going to be turned off by this loud fiddle at the beginning of the song. But the song became a hit, and it really established him as someone a little bit different. He got written up as hard country, or they called him a traditionalist and later a neo-traditionalist. A few years later, he has what is perhaps his defining song, which is the song Amarillo by Morning.
Amarillo by morning, up from San Antonio, everything that I got is just what I've got on.
When that sun is high in that Texas sky, I'll be bucking at the county fair.
It had actually been kicking around Nashville for a while. A guy named Terry Stafford had co-written it and recorded it. A guy named Chris Ledoux, who was a real rodeo competitor, had recorded a version.
I started doing it in the bars with the band, and we kind of developed our own little sound of it.
Right.
And then when I got in the studio, we went even further with that, with the fiddle. And I mean, it was such a great song for me. You know, I loved doing it in the honky tonks. Probably the most requested song that we would get. You know, hey, play Amarillo. Play it again. I just played it.
What's the most times you ever played it in a night?
I wouldn't do it more than twice, and most of the times I wouldn't do it again anyway.
Amarillo by morning. Amarillo's where I'll be.
Have you ever been really surprised by a song that becomes a hit, and you had no idea that it would take off like that?
Well, I did a song that I've come to expect it from you.
Mm-hmm.
That was a number one record for 5 weeks back in the 80s.
Mm.
And I love the song, and I thought it was a great song, and I thought we did a good job of recording it. But I had no idea it was going to be as big a record as it was.
Mm.
Sit and smoke, cry and joke about these tears in my eyes.
No clue. And then I've released some songs that I would have bet the ranch if they would have been a number one record, and they weren't.
Like what?
Well, like Meanwhile.
Mm-hmm.
I cut Meanwhile, and I'm going like, I know that's a hit record. I just love it. I did it for a long, long time in my shows just because I just loved it, but didn't even sniff number one.
She sparkles, she dazzles, she lights up the room. We walk together to a table for two. Every man stares, but her eyes are only for me. We take two.
One of the things that really makes George Strait unusual is longevity and consistency. I mean, year after year, he's releasing single after single. Almost all of them are going into the top 10. He has more than 80 songs in the top 10 of the Billboard Hot Country Songs chart. About half of them are going all the way to number one. And, you know, there is this tradition in country music, including a lot of George Strait's heroes, that have tumultuous lives. You know, Johnny Cash, Merle Haggard. George Strait is unusual in that his was the opposite. He just kind of kept singing song after song. And so by this time, he's become basically the defining voice of country music. And he was producing hit after hit after hit. That said, he also, I think, took some pleasure in every now and again tucking a little surprise into one of his albums. He had a song called Adelaida that was essentially a Zydeco song. It nevertheless became a big radio hit for him. And in 2001, he puts out an album that includes a song called Stars on the Water. It's a song written by Rodney Crowell, and George Strait's version has heavy auto-tune on it. It's really one of the first uses in mainstream pop music of auto-tune, which is a pitch correction software, as a musical instrument, and that's definitely not something that people were expecting from George Strait.
You got stars on the water, and it rains.
Another song that a lot of people weren't necessarily expecting to hear from you that I love is When You Cut El Rey. To me, the fact that, you know, you're someone who grew up in, what, Pearsall, Texas,
mm-hmm.
about 90 minutes maybe from the border. What did cutting a song like El Rey mean to you? How did that come about?
Me and some of my friends used to ride motorcycles, and we rode through Mexico like three times had a blast, and every night we would have mariachis. We would put a mariachi band together or hire one to play for us. I love Vicente Fernandez, and I just, El Rey was just one of my favorite mariachi songs of all times, and I'm going like, I'm going to learn that song, and I'm going to, if I just do it with me and the guitar, I don't care. I took it to Nashville, and I played it for the guys, and they're going like, what? We're going to cut, how are we going to do that? And they did a great arrangement of it, I thought.
Yeah.
I'd heard this girl mariachi band in San Antonio. They were amazing. And I told them, I said, whenever I come back to San Antonio and play the Alamo Dome again, I'm going to get you guys to come up and play with me. And they're going, yeah, right, whatever. After I cut El Rey, I got in touch with them, and we played the Alamo Dome. And I've never heard a crowd go, I mean, that loud in my whole career. I mean, it was unbelievable when they kicked off El Rey.
So George Strait is semi-retired. Again, he's this year he's playing these shows in Las Vegas, but it's not a tour full time. He has lots of time to go golfing and fishing. And the other thing that's changed is that country radio isn't really playing that much George Strait anymore. His last album was the first album of his career that didn't send a song into the top 10 of Billboard's Hot Country Songs chart.
I saw it happen to The Hag. I saw it happen to George Jones.
Willie Nelson.
Willie, I'd seen it happen, you know, and I knew I'm not immune to that, you know, that's going to happen to me.
For a lot of decades, it seemed like you were immune
to that.
Well,
it did, kind of. I hung on for dear life for a lot of years. But, you know, it's to that point now. Mm-hmm. You know, I keep thinking that, you know, I'm going to come across that record that maybe they'll want to play again, but, you know, it's not the end of the world if I don't.
He thinks of himself as an entertainer. He takes pride in that. And if you're no longer getting played on the radio the way you used to, if you're no longer on tour for half the year every year, what metric are you using to determine whether or not you're actually entertaining people? As he starts to think about this part of his career, George Strait has different options. He could go do a passion project, record an album of Frank Sinatra songs or Bob Wills songs, or he could do what Johnny Cash did, go hang out with Rick Rubin and make his version of those Solitary Man albums. Or maybe he gets back in the studio, records some great songs, and radio comes to their senses, and all of a sudden George Strait is back on the radio. I think a lot of people wouldn't complain if that were the case. I was a young troubadour when I wrote it. Song, and I'll be an old troubadour when I'm gone.
George Strait. He spoke with Kelefasane, a staff writer at The New Yorker. You can find Kelefa's profile of Strait and quite a few things he's written about country music over the years at NewYorkerRadio.org. Is that a damned old mirror? Don't really tell the whole truth. It don't show what's deep inside or read between the lines, and it's really no reflection of my youth. Sometimes I feel like Jesse James, still trying to make a name.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. My colleague Lawrence Wright has covered some particularly intimidating topics. He wrote a fantastic book about Scientology, something the Scientologists themselves did everything they could to prevent. And he spent some time in the Middle East and wrote about Al-Qaeda in a book called The Looming Tower, and that won the Pulitzer Prize. For his most recent work, though, he barely had to leave home.
We had what is very formally called an editorial conversation about, I don't know, a year, year and a half ago, and it went a little bit like this. Why don't you write about Texas? And I said, well, maybe I will. And then no more conversation, and a year later you came back with a manuscript, essentially a book, and it'll be a book in March, and we'll talk again at that time. But
my memory of that conversation, David, is you asked me to explain Texas, and I reminded you that I get paid by the word. That's a very big question you just asked.
Well, I got what I deserved, yeah. And thank God for it.
Okay, explain Texas is not as dumb as it sounds, especially to those of you who live there. Larry lives in Austin, and what he set out to do was to look in great depth at what happens in the Capitol, where every statewide office is held by a Republican and has been for quite a while. Larry's article in The New Yorker is called The Future is Texas. And by that, he meant our future, the whole American future.
Larry, I've got to ask you right off the bat. It sounds to me in the era of Trump, we've got two political poles that are establishing themselves independent of Washington. You've got California, which wants to be the kind of liberal opposite of everything Trump, and then you've got Texas.
Right.
How is Texas establishing itself as a political center, and how is this happening, taking shape?
Well, long before the country became as Republican as it is now, Texas was that. In a way, it was the model for the country that we have become. And what's happening in Texas is that the conservative agenda has largely been accomplished, has been years ago. And now the party, the only party in Texas really, the Republicans, are splitting in half between the conservative business-oriented group and the more social, cultural group. And that side has not yet enacted its full agenda, and they are really on the warpath. I have a feeling that, you know, this is a kind of model for what's happening right now in Washington, because the Democrats, just as they have been in Texas, have been sidelined in Washington. And the argument really is between two wings of the Republican Party.
The governor, Greg Abbott, doesn't have much of a national profile like, say, Scott Walker or Jerry Brown. Where does Abbott stand politically?
Well, until this current legislative session, Greg Abbott was seen as a kind of business conservative and a cautious figure. He's popular in Texas, and in part because I think he's quiet and, you know, he doesn't raise quite a lot of ruckus, you know. But he's, this session, the word that I got when I was doing this story and spending a lot of time in the Texas legislature is that he has been terrified of the lieutenant governor, Dan Patrick, running against him. And Patrick is a formidable, probably the most powerful political figure in the state.
He's terrified of his own lieutenant governor.
And even though Patrick said at the beginning of the session he was not going to run against Greg Abbott, Abbott's behavior has been such that he is constantly fearful of being outflanked on the right by his lieutenant governor. So whatever Patrick does, you know, Patrick had a list of several bills that he wanted the governor to pass. He demanded that the governor call a special session, which the governor did.
What did he really want?
Well, there are two things that he wants. One is he wants to have a bill that would cap property taxes. And property taxes is the main way we finance our schools in Texas. It's a way of smothering public schools. In Dan Patrick's world, you know, we'd be moving to private schools and vouchers. But and that's something that he's fought for very hard.
He wants to crush public schools.
Well, he's defunding them, and, you know, that's the same thing, as far as I can see. And then the other thing that he's avid for is a bathroom bill, as we call it. He calls it the Women's Right to Privacy Act. Now, I've spent a lot of time listening to the testimony. I can tell you that there were trans people coming in who, you know, for instance, people who had been girls when they were born with full beards and male pattern baldness, where are they supposed to go to the bathroom? And there's not much time spent on taking care of their concerns.
Now, is this what their constituents want? Is this what suburban Texas constituents want above all from their legislators? Or are these legislators going above and beyond the cultural call of duty?
No, the majority of Texans don't care about the bathroom bill. The Republicans, especially in the suburbs, are passionate about immigration, however. And so, you know, the Sanctuary Cities bill is very popular in the suburbs. You know, there's a lot of feeling that, you know, that, and this is where the,
to,
know, cross
to punish a, sanctuary cities in some
yes,
way.
Yes, and our sheriff, who was just elected, Sally Hernandez, had campaigned on a kind of sanctuary cities platform. And the governor withdrew $1.5 million of state funds immediately from Travis County, which is Austin, and been lampooning her on the, you know, he calls her Sanctuary Sally and so on. But they passed a law that would imprison somebody like our sheriff if she refuses to hold in jail a person that the immigration officials might be interested in.
Now, Larry, if I remember right, you were born in Oklahoma, but you've lived in Texas virtually your entire life.
Yeah.
But we both were born at a time when the most liberal inheritor in the presidency of the FDR New Deal model was Lyndon Baines Johnson,
right,
a Texan. So how do you view the evolution of Texas politics? Why did it get so conservative? What happened in Texas?
Well, you know, I had this conversation the other day with Karl Rove, who I have a regular breakfast group on Monday, and Karl sits in every once in a while. And I was asking him about how Texas turned so red, given that it had a very progressive background. And he said he didn't really think of it as a progressive background, that it was more a populist one, and that the populists believe that somebody's after them. And the Texas populists of old believed that it was the Wall Street bankers that were screwing the little guy. But that's changed. Now they believe that it's government. And government is the enemy that's taking advantage of the little guy.
Here we're sitting here in New York, where you, thank God, come visit us every once in a while. President Johnson once complained that the greatest bigots in the world are the Democrats on the east side of New York, especially when they're thinking about Texans.
Right.
You get that a lot? Do you feel that the rest of the country, particularly the big bad eastern elites along the Amtrak corridor, look down on Texas?
Oh, they do. It's not a feeling. You know, it's openly expressed. But I've often thought, you know, when people think of Texas, you know, they think of us as, you know, braggarts, as, you know, kind of having a careless personal lives and, you know, up and down, narcissistic and caring only about ourselves and so on. And
you referred, I think you refer to the Eastern attitude toward Texans as the Texans have the, they possess the nation's id.
Yes. And I've thought the politician who most expresses that is probably Donald Trump. And if he'd put on a cowboy hat rather than a gimme cap, I think people would have recognized him in a way. But I do wonder, will Manhattan ever be held to account the way Texas is for its political figures? I haven't seen it.
Well, I think he isn't he getting held to account, Trump?
Is expressing a Manhattan
no.
cultural ideal? I don't think so.
No, you make a good point. Yeah. Larry, you've written that Texas bears the responsibility of being the future.
Yeah.
What is it about the state that makes you think it has a certain kind of destiny, political or otherwise?
Well, for one thing, it's growing so fast. It's outsized growth, and it's expected to double by 2050.
Why is it growing so fast?
Well, jobs mainly. It's you know, been a tremendous job center. It hasn't necessarily produced the kind of good-paying jobs that one would hope for, but still it has a tremendous amount of opportunity.
And how will the population boom in Texas affect its politics, do you think?
Well, immigration in Texas is one of the things that turned it red initially. You know, it was in-migration of non-Texans into the cities from the Midwest and from the coast who had different political traditions than the kind of progressive Democrats that we had in office in the 50s and early 60s. They brought a different tradition, and it was Dallas, where I grew up, that became the first Republican city when it elected Bruce Alger, a real right-wing congressman, and John Tower then became our first senator. And that was a break with the past. It's interesting now, you know, those people filled in the suburbs, and the suburbs are where the redness really gets bright.
So when people talk about and have written about the coming purple Texas, a political transformation of Texas, this is kind of stars in the eyes in the Democratic Party about Texas. Do you believe it?
Well, you know, Texas would be blue now if people actually voted.
Why is that?
Well, it's been said that, you know, because it's ethnically, you know, the Mexican Americans don't vote. But the truth is, the people who don't vote are the young, the poor, and the poorly educated. And that's what we have in abundance in Texas. And there's an effort by the Republican establishment to keep those people from voting. The voter ID laws that have been enacted repeatedly and repeatedly overturned by the Supreme Court, you know, this is a total effort at disenfranchisement. There's very little money put into the schools.
Hillary Clinton made a big ad buy.
Yeah.
I thought she had a shot at Texas. At least for a while, thought
she
had a
shot at Texas. She was ahead by 1 point at one point, and that was—
But was she deluded?
Yeah, I think, you know, her campaign manager, Gary Morrow, said Texas is not in the balance.
You think it'll be in the balance in our lifetime?
Oh, yeah, I think it could be. I think the thing is that both parties in Texas are fragile. You know, the Democratic Party doesn't even have offices in a lot of counties in Texas.
The portrait you paint of it is that it's disorganized, depleted, leaderless, rudderless.
And they're now desperately seeking celebrities to run for offices.
Who does it want to get?
Tommy Lee Jones would be top of the list for some. And he'd be hard to vote against. You know,
he does have that craggy look.
But the Republican Party is also divided. It's in a way, it's akin to what the Democratic Party in Texas was decades ago, which was really two parties.
Do you feel hopeful about the direction of all of this for Texas?
No, I'm not hopeful. I'm upset. You know, as a citizen of Texas, I'm disturbed at the direction that it's taking. It's, you know, Texas is a marvelous, dynamic entity. And it's got tremendous resources and great people and, you know, and a possible wonderful future. But it's not going to be wonderful if we don't educate our children and if we don't take care of the health and welfare of our citizens. And that's where the state's falling down.
Larry, thanks.
My pleasure.
You can find Larry Wright's The Future is Texas and everything he's written for The New Yorker at newyorkerradio.org. The cartoonist Liana Fink has an unusual ritual in her working life. Once a week, maybe, she leaves the house early and buys a ticket for the Long Island Railroad, the commuter line going east from New York City. But Liana's not actually going anywhere. She just likes riding the train. She likes the hubbub. She likes to be around people without quite getting sucked into conversation. It's a chance to clear her mind and just work.
I like to come up with New Yorker cartoons on the train. It's good because I don't have a fixed workspace, so I started working in fancy cafes, and those are wonderful, but they are obnoxious. Like, people are always eyeing your table because they want to sit at it. I can't stand when people talk to me when I'm working, but I love when they talk to each other. I don't like to be in a vacuum when I'm drawing. I think my ideal would really be to be a ghost and get to be around people all the time.
Number four, please.
A train is better because people are mostly facing the same way. No one's going to look you in the eye.
There we go, change in Babylon.
It's after sunrise, but not very long after, and the sky is grayish and cloudy, and there's a 7-Eleven and an auto body shop and a lot of cars, and it's a type of bleak that I like. It's maybe suburban sprawl.
Freeport Station, America's Next, this is Freeport.
I'm always mean to start coming up with cartoons on the train, but sometimes I just send emails and look out the window. But I start to feel free in a certain way. I think one of the nice things about the train is that I can't really do, like, perfectly finished work on it. I have to, like, I can't make a finished cartoon. I have to just come up with ideas. And I think, like, my favorite thing to do is just to think and to play. And on the train, I'm forced to just think and doodle.
Station is Lindenberg. Babylon is next.
We're transferring at Babylon. We just got onto a fancier train with higher headrests and 2 stories and a bathroom. I printed out an old batch of New Yorker cartoons that I liked a lot that didn't sell, even though I thought they were really good that time. And I'm going to look at them and see if I can make them clearer, and maybe this time they'll sell. So this one is a pine tree with an air freshener dangling from it that is shaped like a car. That's good. I don't need to fix that one up. This is a hall of statues. Oh, I guess they're busts on pillars. That says hall of life-size Pez dispensers. This one doesn't bring me joy anymore. I don't think it's funny anymore. I don't think it ever was. This one is interesting. I think this one brings me joy. It says pigeon nest, and it's a nest on a tree that's made of garbage. I love pigeons, and I think I need to think more about, like, maybe the reason this isn't a good cartoon yet is that it's on a tree. Maybe a pigeon nest isn't on a tree. Like, I'll think about that. Oh, here's a stupid one. It's a bird inside a gator's mouth, and the bird is saying, "Do you even floss?" I have really good dental hygiene. Birds are like the dentist's patron animal because they do clean the mouths of some kind of gator, Ala or Kraka. The gator does not look anatomically correct. I once saw an iguana that got loose from its container on a train, and it was just walking like really slowly down the train aisle, and then its owner didn't realize that it had escaped, and everyone's just kind of like, what's that? It was really big. It's getting really beautiful outside. There's a pond out the window with those things that look like wheat coming out of it. The houses are, they look like a fisherman might live in them. It looks like it's, the town has been this way for a long time. I love that it doesn't look brand new. It's funny, like I don't think I'm telling you accurate stuff about what I think about on the train, because my drawing self, I think, is one self and my talking self is another self, and I just like can't access the drawing self when I'm talking. My drawing self is smart and savvy and knows exactly what she's doing, and my talking self is kind of a human impersonator. Like in my drawing, I feel like I can be anyone. Like I can channel all kinds of personalities and thoughts, and I don't tell myself what to draw. It just comes out. When I'm in the city, I feel like my social self, which isn't exactly my real self, is just on high alert, and she's always expecting someone to talk to her. But on the train, you have no choices, and no one's gonna talk to you. And I get to just like put her on a shelf a bit more, and then ideas come out. The drawing self gets to be alive again. It's almost time for us to get off. I always wish that I had a lot longer, and that's a nice feeling.
Liana Fink on the Long Island Railroad. We've got some of her work up at newyorkerradio.org. Coming up, a young Irish novelist who's making waves here in the States. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I'd like to introduce you now to a young writer from Ireland named Sally Rooney. Rooney is a classic overachiever. In college, she got into competitive debate and ended up as the number one debater in all of Europe. At 23, Rooney sat down to write a novel, which she did, writing most of the novel in just 3 months. That novel got published and has been getting tons of buzz and excited reviews, including a great review in The New Yorker from staff writer Alexandra Schwartz.
It's been a long time since I've been as excited about a novel, and particularly a debut novel, as I've been about conversations with friends. It is a story about a young student at Trinity College Dublin named Frances and her best friend Bobby. They are brainy, brilliant, very talkative young women who have a ton of ideas about the world. And they become wrapped up in the lives of an older couple, Melissa and Nick. Frances starts an affair with Nick, and her life changes suddenly. So this novel felt very true to me about a particular time in the early 20s. You're about to go off into the adult world. You have all sorts of ideas and theories about how things work, but you have not yet had to go through any kind of intense personal or moral struggle. And it's a confusing moment. Frances is a really principled person. She is a smart, hyper-articulate narrator, but she's not always so smart about herself and about what she is about to face. And I asked Sally Rooney to read a passage in which Frances explains her thinking about what comes next for her.
I hadn't been kidding with Philip about not wanting a job. I didn't want one. I had no plans as to my future financial sustainability. I never wanted to earn money for doing anything. I'd had various minimum wage jobs in previous summers, sending emails, making cold calls, things like that. And I expected to have more of them after I graduated. Though I knew that I would eventually have to enter full-time employment, I certainly never fantasized about a radiant future where I was paid to perform an economic role. Sometimes this felt like a failure to take an interest in my own life, which depressed me. On the other hand, I felt that my disinterest in wealth was ideologically healthy. I'd checked what the average yearly income would be if the gross world product were divided evenly among everyone, and according to Wikipedia, it would be $16,100. I saw no reason, political or financial, ever to make more money than that.
I love this passage because it seems so true to me, and it also, it seems both very knowing and accurate and also totally misguided, which I love. And that's something that I love about this character as well. Is that a feeling that you had ever about money and jobs, sort of wanting to opt out of the whole corrupt system?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, one of the funny things for me in having these discussions is that when I began writing the book, and in fact, even when I finished the first draft, I was 23 years old and Frances, the narrator, is 21. So the gap between us was really pretty narrow. I was writing very closely, not about my personal experiences, but about a vision of the world that I identified with really closely. And the more that the years go on, and of course, I'm only 26 now, so it's still not a huge gap, I begin to look at Frances's way of seeing the world with a bit more distance. And I obviously see that in a way, her performance of integrity and of rejection of, you know, systems like capitalism. And she's also trying, maybe in a way, to defer her adulthood. And I don't mean that in a sort of trite way. I think she enjoys the adult world. She enjoys navigating challenges some of the time. But I think she hates the idea of having to compromise her principles. And that adulthood will always necessarily involve compromise.
Yeah, it seems to me that she is right in her ideas, and that her ideas are accurate about the world and some of the world's cynicism, and she wants to avoid participating in it. But, you know, how? That's the real question.
Yeah.
Well, we should say for listeners who are concerned that this is a novel only about ideas, that it's also a novel about love and desire as a very real and experienced thing. What was it like to write about that kind of visceral experience of attraction and betrayal that may come from attraction?
That for me was definitely the motivating sort of key behind the book. And it was when I was writing a scene early on in the book where they're at a dinner party that I realized Frances is going to fall for Nick, the married man, that it suddenly everything opened out in front of me. And it was almost kind of like having an affair because I was thinking about the book all day. And when I was in class, I just wanted to get back to the book. And so it was almost like I was infatuated with the idea of being with this book all the time. For me, it's inextricable. The kind of the substance of the book about desire, about infatuation is so linked for me with the experience of writing it that I couldn't possibly separate the two.
There is one moment that I really love in the novel where and feels just so true to me about the way we all live our lives now, where Frances sees a Facebook video of Melissa and Nick singing in their home. And it's like this really tender moment between them as a couple, and all their friends are there and they're laughing. And it's just part of a life that doesn't include her at all. And we all, of course, take it so much for granted at this point, but that we have these really intimate windows into both banal and extremely momentous moments in other people's lives through Facebook, sometimes on Twitter, definitely on Instagram. What was that like to try to write the way we live now through all these different platforms?
I wasn't really aware of myself doing it. I guess because I spend so much time on the internet and do so much of my communication, even with very close friends over the internet, that it felt second nature to me to draw those things into the book. It's not just that some of the conversations occur in real life and some occur online. It's that Frances has a particular relationship, I think, with textuality. Like, she feels like she has a measure of control when she's writing emails, but she's also very concerned with archiving her relationships. And at one point she's quite frustrated that she doesn't have a satisfying archive of messages with Nick, because obviously most of their affair has at this point been conducted in real life. So it's very, very important for her to have a sort of permanent case file of her relationships. The closest thing to which in history and in the history of the novel, I guess, would be a trove of letters. And there's, you know, just as the letter has been hugely significant in the development of the novel, I think probably the email and instant message and text message are going to be increasingly significant because the novel's so much about communication and because the way that we communicate has radically changed.
Yeah, of course, one thing that you can do, all of us are walking around with an archive of our personal conversations and relationships, and you can search them. It did occur to me in my early 20s when I had a very intense friendship that was took place a lot over email. I have a record of those years that I didn't keep in any other form. I didn't keep it in a diary or in a journal, and I don't know what to make of my own personal archive. I wonder if you know what to make of yours. I know it's there, but do I want to really read it? Unclear.
Oh, I don't want to read it. Most of the time, I would hate to think of myself reading it. And yet, if someone was to tell me that it was all deleted, I would feel like a sense of loss. I would be like, oh my God, all my emails, all my correspondence with friends, all the sort of archive of what I was doing. I expect that now. I expect to have this archive, this daily detailed archive of my entire life. And if it were taken away from me, I think I would feel almost sort of bereaved.
Yeah, and yet we walk around with that possibility sort of at all times. What if Gmail doesn't exist? What if the server is hacked? I think about this a lot. And your novel made me think about it even more. You were a university debater. You wrote a really wonderful essay about that experience. And you were more than a university debater. You were a champion debater. You were number one in Europe. You write in your essay about this feeling of competition and wanting to prove yourself the best. Can you talk a little bit about that, what it was like for you to debate, what that kind of intellectual performance was like?
Yeah, it was very challenging experience. And part of getting acclimatized to it was sort of getting to know a new social environment, which I'd never had any contact with before. So I had never done debating in school. I went to school in the west of Ireland. And when I got to college, a lot of the people who were participating in it were people who had been to private schools in Dublin and elsewhere, and who had come from a sort of hothouse culture of debating. I kind of wonder what it was that drove me to spend or potentially waste so much time doing something that the only reward for which was being good at it, being told you're good at this. And it was, I obviously craved that, and I spent a lot of time looking for it, and I eventually got it and then felt that maybe it hadn't been worth all the time that I spent on it. But I certainly, in making such an effort to try and fit into a social milieu in which I didn't kind of naturally belong, I think I learned a lot and I got a lot of experience that probably in very indirect ways ended up in the novel.
So it's a very particular thing to have your first novel published, because basically before you publish your first novel, you get to do everything in secret. And now you're not in secret anymore. The veil has been pulled away and here you are. Does that change how you live in the world? Does that change how you write your next novel? How is it to be a published author for the first time?
It's stranger than I thought it would be. I think I sort of anticipated in my wildest dreams, I sort of thought maybe the book will get, you know, a lot of attention and how wonderful that would be. And people will be reading the book and talking about the book. And what I didn't anticipate is that people would start taking an interest in me personally and sort of the story of how I wrote the book and sort of my thoughts and even my personal life, my experiences. And I think it's like having to speak about myself so much. It's like, you know, when you hear a word so often that it kind of stops making sense. It's like that, but the word is my personality. Now I'm like, what kind of person am I? I don't know. So it's been a little bit strange. And obviously it does mean that I can never do it again. You know, I can never have that first book where I just write it and I tell people I'm writing a novel and, you know, they kind of laugh. But it has changed a lot. And in 99% of ways, the change has been immensely positive. And maybe with 1% of the change, I'm still kind of trying to get my head around what it means. Thank you, Sally. It was a total pleasure.
Thanks so much. This has really been lovely.
Novelist Sally Rooney talking with The New Yorker's Alexandra Schwartz. Conversations with Friends is out now. So that wraps it up today, or just about. Before we go, why don't we go visit the museum? And of course, we'll pay for the audio tour because it's read by a celebrity, Taryn Killam, formerly of Saturday Night Live.
Thank you for purchasing this museum audio guide. Your tour will begin shortly.
This frenetic painting by Jackson Pollock is typical of his drip style, which features gestural splatters of paint across the canvas, and I know what you're thinking. You're thinking that this type of painting is easy, and that you could do it. It's not, and you couldn't. Here it is, the Mona Lisa. It's not very big. You're now surrounded by 70 people, all trying to catch a glimpse of it. Ooh, one of them just elbowed you while you were taking a photograph of it. What I'm trying to say is, it's okay to feel disappointed. As you can see, this room is a bunch of rugs hanging on a wall, so we can skip it. This sculpture, you'll notice, is a tube sticking out of an orange cardboard box. You're wondering, is there something I'm missing? No, there is not. This is a bad sculpture. Ugh. Look at this guy, strolling through the museum without an audio guide, not even a map. Oh, God. Now he's stroking his chin and nodding thoughtfully at a Rembrandt. Christ. Let's keep moving. We don't need him. Paul Cézanne completed this landscape in 1879. And you can touch it right now if you want to. Quick, no one's looking. The Gift Shop dates back to 1983, but was made bigger in 1997. I'm sorry. What am I doing with my life? I have to go. I'm sorry.
Taryn Killam performing Honest Museum Audio Tour. Written for The New Yorker by River Clegg. That's The New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Raphael, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Susan Morrison, Emma Allen, Jessica Henderson, and Terrence Bernardo. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.